So that's it for Sage and Studio. Subscribe to the podcast on sageandstudio.org or facebook.com/stage, the letter and studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. More music by Idris Goodwin.
For every dime, legal money ain't never broke. The words that I've spoke have made me a buck or two. Eat good, live comfortable from language.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Stuart Harvey, a photographer whose show Burning Man Pas de Deux, with work by another photographer, Marty, is on now at the Mark Woolley Gallery at Pioneer Place through November the 15th. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you very much for asking me.
This show is all pictures from Burning Man over 25 years. One of the sort of gripping images is called Playa Crossing, Playa being the desert. Just tell us, what is Burning Man and how you get there, or how you got there?
Well, how we got to the Playa is an interesting story. Burning Man, as most people know, began in San Francisco in 1986 and was started by my brother and a friend of his, Jerry James.
Your brother, Larry?
Larry Harvey, yes. They used to take a man down to Solstice Party that they always went to, and they would set him on fire. And he was a rather insignificant figure in 1986. But after that burn, they started getting serious about making him larger. It became kind of an early internet phenomena. And by 1989, when my son Brian and I first went down, it had grown to about 500 people who would gather on the beach, and they would haul the figure down in seven parts and assemble it on the beach, dig two holes at the base of the feet, and pull him upright. In 1990, they went down to burn the man, and the authorities, mm-hmm. park authorities, the Army, because Baker Beach was part of the Presidio in those days, and other authorities wanted to know where their event permits were, and of course, it was a totally guerrilla activity. They had a long conference and negotiation, and finally they said, well, you can put him up, but you can't set him on fire, and nearly caused a riot in the crowd. Some of those early burners were members of what was called the Cacophony Society, and they had already planned this kind of desert cocktail party in the on the Nevada desert, Black Rock Desert in northern Nevada. And so they invited Larry to bring the man to the Playa. He called me and told me about it, and I decided that I'd like to go, and my son decided he'd like to go. And so that desert crossing was taken that first weekend in 1990, mm-hmm. and communicates a lot about the vast openness of the Black Rock Desert. And I feel that had they not had the good fortune of being invited to take the event there, We probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. You think it would have fizzled out if it was still on a beach?
I think it would have been very difficult to grow an event on an urban beach that would deal with 70,000 people in a reasonable way.
Right.
Just physically would have been impossible. I think the other thing, though, is the desert is a magical place. It's something that virtually everyone who goes feels some almost primordial kinship with. It brings us back to our origins as creatures on Earth. It's so large that it demands big behaviors. And that resulted in big art and outlandish events and big numbers. Mm-hmm. And it's so wide open, so free-spirited, that individuals allow their imaginations to get the better of them. And the results have been impressive.
Mm-hmm. Just to remind everyone, that these days it's how many people? 70,000?
Yeah,
roughly?
It's contractually limited with the BLM to 70,000. That's a daily figure. It's an average figure. So sometimes I think they rob Peter to pay Paul and take some of that space that isn't occupied by numbers early in the week and maybe there are a few more people that get in by the end of the week. That's just my guess.
So there's this big city, a sort of tent camp city. Some people are in trailers, some people are in tents, and it's in a big three quarters of a circle.
There's actually a perimeter fence that's 7 miles in diameter.
Right.
And then the camp itself is located within.
Yeah. And when you go beyond the perimeter, say at night, there's all this art like trundling around, cars, lights. It's like going into outer space. You know, you don't know what you're going to find, right? You need a bike or something.
Absolutely. You've got to navigate the thing. A bicycle's almost mandatory. So, now, there are big art cars. There are other kinds of vehicles. Although these days, in the early days when we drove, and that picture that you introed with was a picture of us just driving on the playa.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go there by getting coordinates. You would get an envelope in the mail, and it would say, from the point of entering the playa, go east 6 miles and then turn north for 4 miles. The desert is so flat and shimmering that in midday, it will swallow a pretty large encampment. Unless you're within about half mile or mile away from it, you could blow right by the whole thing.
You just can't see, right? Because of the glare and
it's a mirage effect. A vehicle approaching you seems to come out of nowhere, comes out of the shimmer that's ahead of you. In the early days, we would speed across the playa. It sort of invites you to tromp on the gas.
This is called Cadillac Playa Crossing, right? You're driving a big old Cadillac.
It's a big old convertible, yeah.
It sounds like On the Road, where Dean gets that Cadillac and he thrashes it across America, and it's just a pile of junk by the end. But he's going like 90 miles an hour.
Well, we were going fast. Actually, I think Brian was driving, and I was leaning out the window. And we would hit these windrows of dust that had been sculpted. And they kept getting deeper and deeper. And there was a point where we hit one hard enough to drive the nose of the car into the sand, and it splashed up over the windshield. And it was time to settle down and get real.
So you're doing coordinates. This is before GPS. You're doing them on paper and a map with a compass.
Actually, yeah, and staring at a compass, and the needle would wiggle back and forth. And so you were supposed to be heading due east, but it was really hard to tell exactly where due east was. And so I was always, you know, whoever was manning the compass had to be pretty careful, especially at night. A few years into the mid-90s, it would seem like it was always dark by the time we'd get down there. And that made everything even more difficult. Although occasionally you'd see a glimmer of a light. That light might be a taillight of a truck that was going in the opposite direction. And so it was really tricky to find it at night.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Stuart Harvey. His show with Marty, called Burning Man Pas de Deux, is on now at the Mark Woolley Gallery at Pioneer Place through November the 15th. So this show isn't just your work. There's a photographer called Marty has half the show. So who's Marty and how did this happen?
Well, Marty's a woman who lives in Paris who I used to run into from time to time in the middle of dust storms. We would often be hiding out behind a piece of sculpture, and I realized she was a kindred spirit because we were the only two photographers stupid enough to be out there in the middle of a dust storm. Over time, I got familiar with her work. She does a very interesting, I would call sort of surreal approach to Burning Man photography with wide lenses, and I've used panorama. So it seemed natural, and we've talked about it off and on for 2 or 3 years and finally decided that it was time to do a show together.
This is great for a photographer. You're a studio photographer at this point, and you're taking pictures. What was your motto?
Yeah, no job too humiliating. With
so that's
the motto of the studio. Actually, my studio partner Jim Lomason coined that one. But
so that's pets, weddings,
you
kids.
Name it, we did it.
So when you get out to the desert, it's like in this fantastic playground, I guess, for a photographer.
Oh, absolutely, and I had been doing using panorama cameras in Portland for a number of years, and it just seemed like a natural to use the Widelux or the X-Pan later on. And so my first significant photographs at Burning Man were done with panorama cameras.
Mm-hmm.
I don't photograph the art per se. There's often an art piece mm-hmm. somewhere in it because they're kind of unavoidable. I'm interested in the interaction between people and the art. I'm interested in the interaction between the art and the playa. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the way people interact with the playa. Sometimes when the dust kicks up and you see a lone figure, it just seems otherworldly. I mean, you could be on Mars for that moment. And I think that's one of the great things about Burning Man. The playa helps you into a headspace that you just don't have it here in the city. You
know? Mm-hmm.
It's a surreal experience.
There's a fantastic picture called First Burn Crowd, and it's people watching the burn, and they look so, it's 1990, and they look so like fortunate that they're there because they're dressed differently. No, nobody dresses like that there now. So you've got a guy in a bow tie and a blazer. You've got a woman with a little Instamatic camera and on a string around her wrist. And she's got a T-shirt tucked into like mom jeans, basically. And there's some kids there and they're just staring at fire, right?
Yeah.
Is that what they're doing?
And they're watching the burn and they're fascinated and mesmerized, but it does speak to the evolution of the event. The first people to go to Burning Man were just friends and family. Most of them were San Francisco cronies, members of the Cacophony Society, and they were there as ordinary people. The idea of taking on persona and wearing costumes kind of got started there because the Cacophony people showed up in costume. But for the most part, it was pretty much ordinary folk.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us knew what we were getting into. I mean, it wasn't a city. It was a haphazard collection of cars and tents. A little cluster here. There was a parachute that had been an orange and white parachute that had been draped over some kind of shape, and it had a pirate flag attached to it. And that was the closest thing to a camp or city center as we had. And that actually stayed that way for 2 or 3 years before
mm-hmm.
people got to actually start building things. You know, so it was pretty haphazard.
In the genres of pictures that one can take there, the burn picture, where does that rank as a genre?
That's a little like taking a sunset picture. Although occasionally you'll get a burn picture that is more evocative. It's more than just pyro and a big explosion. The one in my show that I like the best is called Burn Spectre. And it's just the fact that there's a figure in front of the burn that looks kind of exotic, arabesque, and
mm-hmm.
and the smoke has obscured the bottom half, so the man feels like he's floating as a ghostly kind of apparition. And so I like burn pictures that evoke more than a burning guy on fire, or a burning wooden structure on fire.
Yeah. That guy, Bern Spector, is he wearing like a cloak?
Yeah, he's wearing some sort of costume, and I honestly don't know what he's, you know, who he's supposed to be. He might be part of a performance that was going on. There's a group called the Fire Conclave that now does fire performances prior to the burn. He might have been, this is an earlier picture, so he might have been part of something.
Is that like fire dancing?
Like fire dancing, yeah. Drumming, flaming bullwhips, I call it fire spitting. In fact, one year a fire spitter came over to me and he was going to blow a big fire column for me. And it didn't light, and he just spit kerosene all over me and my camera, and it ruined my hat. I never forgave him.
many of the pictures, you said you don't particularly go out and take pictures of art. You're not documenting, although you began just documenting what was happening like a journalist, but then you moved into more work that would...
I saw my role initially because... I was a photographer by trade, and my brother had invited me to come down. I saw my role as sort of the historian of the event in the first two or three years. But as I began to make photographs that spoke to me as an artist, I gradually shifted my... And then there were plenty of other people by then who were seriously documenting or who were journalists or photojournalists. Mm-hmm. There were... Probably Wired Magazine was the first national magazine that kind of got on to Burning Man in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And they did I was actually on the cover that year. They did a full article on Burning Man called Welcome to Burning Man that publicized the event. That was the first national exposure. Mm-hmm. And then they followed that up with a book. So... I could just do my thing after that.
So you're looking at people, you're not doing straight up portraits, right, of people in costume. You're doing pictures where they're interacting somehow with the landscape or the arts.
I'm interested in the kind of photography that at least appears to reveal something beyond what's actually in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And so there's a moment that you can catch where people are interacting in a particular way and the light is doing something or the dust is doing something. And it makes the photographs feel bigger and more penetrating than it probably was in real life. Mm-hmm. I think that's the magic of photography. The still camera can do something that no other medium can do when it freezes a moment. Mm-hmm. And if the moment's right, then you feel like that it has revealed some secret that's contained in the facade of reality. You've penetrated the mask, as Melville used to say. And that's the goal. You know, you take pictures and one of them, that feels like it tells you a little bit more than the one before it or the one after it. And those are the ones I'm after.
Mm-hmm. The picture I loved is called Ken Hamazaki Tea Ceremony, 2001. So there's a guy sitting under a big parasol thing and he's doing a tea ceremony and sitting up very straight and he's got the tea stuff ready and there's an empty space on the other side of the mat for whoever shows up. And then there's a woman riding a bike along. She's got a parasol on her bike. And she's sort of, you know, I don't know if she's got goggles on or what. She's ready for, you know, how rough and tough it is. But she's looking at him like she's riding by and is like, oh, maybe I could go and do that. I could join in. But it's just her angle of her body and the angle of the parasols makes it a little moment. Yeah. Although he's not really looking at her.
No, he's not looking at her. He's absorbed in the ritual.
And who is this guy, Ken Hamasaki? And
Ken has been coming to Burning Man since about 2000. And I took that one in 2001, and that's when I met Ken. He's one of those artists that is incredibly loyal to the event, who spends his personal resources to come each year, and he does the tea ceremony every Thursday at 4 o'clock.
So he just does it once, though.
He does it once. Now, last year, he participated in the theme was called Caravansary, and it was based on the caravan trail that was in Europe, and they had these little, they called it the souk. It was a series of little shops, although no one's allowed to sell anything, but you would barter, and then you would make the barter a gift. Mm-hmm. And Ken was doing the tea ceremony as part of that. And that was a special moment for him. But I think he's very representative of the kind of artistic energy that comes to Burning Man. Yes, some of the bigger pieces of art are funded. Not usually completely, though.
Funded? What do you mean funded?
Well, there's the very large pieces, which can be tens of thousands of dollars. Artists will make application. The art, in order for a piece of art to receive a grant, it has to be theme art. It has to address the theme for mm-hmm. that year. And there's a yearly competition. Artists submit drawings and a prospectus for this piece they envision. Mm-hmm. And if they're selected, then they get a chunk of money towards putting that together.
Who gives them the money?
Burning Man does. Burning Man probably gives more money to art than the average state gives to art on a yearly basis. They fund thousands. They dump tens of thousands of dollars on artists.
Mm-hmm. So Ken is one of these loners who does it on his own.
He does it on his own. Now, I do not know enough about personal whether he gets a stipend to come over. He's been doing it for a long time. He might very well. He certainly would deserve it. But it's more the loyalty, the fact that year after year, people bring art cars that they've spent their own money on. Year after year, there are recurrent art pieces. An artist may not get funded. He'll still do the piece mm-hmm. of art.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's something he really wants to do and he feels passionate.
There are temples there. People build these wooden temples and then burn them. So there's one called, there's a picture of yours called Temple of Tears Burning. And then there's another one called Temple Interior and another one called Temple Mourning. So they're all different moments, but Temple Interior is a bunch of people sort of praying, sitting there looking at photos and mementos. So that's a temple where you bring something of someone you've lost.
The temples began in the year 2000. A sculptor by the name of David Best from Petaluma, California, built the first temple, and he did it as a personal memorial to a friend of his that had died. It was not a large temple. It was about a third of the size of a contemporary temple. But it drew a crowd. And one of the things that happened were people began to inscribe memorial messages on the interior of the temple or draw pictures or whatever. And that phenomena has taken off. Some people will argue that it's the temple burn that they find the most evocative thing that happens at Burning Man. Over the years, David's built 8 of the temples, and they're quite large. All week long, people make a pilgrimage to the temple. They're there 24 hours a day. They bring elaborate memorials. The temple speaks to something that's universal in all of us, and that we all have pain. We all have experienced loss. And it seems that the temple is sort of the fitting denouement for the burn. When the burn happens, it's a big raucous party.
Mm-hmm.
When the temple burns, people are absolutely silent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of kind of winding down after the event, but it also gives Burning Man a significance that's expanded the experience of going there. And I'm a big fan of the temples. I'm a big fan of David Best, and the temple cult liked spreading
around Busu and around. You know, they're just sort of hanging around. What do people do at dawn?
That's a typical scene. Well, a lot of people who are there at dawn are there because they've stayed up all night.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a tradition. The hard partiers, the ravers, the people that are really there, younger people, I would say in my case, they're partying all night, and their goal is to make it to sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
And there usually are a couple of big sound mutant vehicles. There's a big one that looks like a dragon that's called Abraxas that has been to the Oregon Country Fair, and it's got a huge sound system, and there's people that will parade out. There's an annual white parade that goes out on a Friday, I think it's Friday morning, at sunrise. Everybody wears white.
Mm-hmm.
And so there'll be a few hundred people in white that go out, and they'll conduct some kind of ceremony at the temple. The sun will come up and they'll socialize, and then they all go back home and have breakfast and go to sleep. So it's not, I guess the answer is it's not untypical to see a big menage of people,
mm-hmm,
at these various sites,
right,
particularly the temple.
And then, you know, it's become known for its people go there in costume, and yeah, it's a bit of a Mardi Gras thing. But then you have these consistent characters like Rasper. There's a picture of Rasper, 2011. And is that short for Rasputin? He's got like...
No, it's actually his actual last name.
Okay.
His name is Stephen Rasper. And Stephen is part of the organization, has been for a number of years. He's involved in the art, part of the art aspect of mm-hmm, the organization. And he's just an all-around character. He's been growing this beard ever since I've known him, which I've probably known him since the late 90s. And it's 4 or 5 feet long. Mm-hmm. It's all encased in wire.
It's like a big rope.
Yeah, basically. It kind of looks like a serpent. He looks like, yeah, one of those guys that wears a python around his neck.
Yeah.
And he always dresses up in outlandish
fashion.
And he's
got like white contact lenses, you know.
Yeah,
in
he
the
does
picture,
that sometimes.
Does.
Yeah.
Are these characters, how much of it is just playing a character, and
but in
how
his
much
case,
they believe
it's
in their own publicity?
It's virtually a persona. I mean, he really is. He really is this character. Although he does have a life in the default world,
mm-hmm,
and so he actually has a job and, you know, a career. But there's the first bona fide character at Burning Man I saw in 1993, and it was a fellow by the name of Kimrick Smythe, who was one of the first guys to do a pyro. He was the first pyrotechnician at Burning Man, and he did a variety of things, but he had a character that he called the Java Cow, and he would go out at dawn wearing a cow skull, and he had his loyal steed, which was a horse, I suppose a part of him from a fair or a merry-go-round that he had on a little wagon, and he had a faithful servant that would push him riding this horse out to the ply, and he'd go out at sunrise with a big thermos and a few cups. And anyone who gathered in those days, if you got half a dozen people up at sunrise, it was a miracle. And so we would be out there, and his ritual was, does anyone want cream and sugar? And we were supposed to say, no, we want it black. And so then the coffee would be poured, and we would have coffee at sunrise at Burning Man. But, you know, and then he was the first guy I know that had a persona.
Right. Now, and there used to be a kind of a, you know, ask my permission to take my photo kind of vibe, right? There was a sort of a strong no photos, please. But what's it like now?
Yeah, it really was an evolution. Originally, everybody was okay with it. And then there was a phase in sort of the middle and early 2000s when people began to feel like they were being exploited with photography. Now it's reversed. It's because of social media, I suspect. People walk around in beautifully thought out and executed costumes, and they're really interested in posing. There's enormous numbers of pictures. I mean, you could take pictures of people doing selfies forever at Burning Man, and it'd be really boring, but you could. Everybody wants to pose. Everybody imagines they're going to go viral on YouTube. And so, yeah, it's quite the reverse now. It's pictures of people taking pictures of people taking pictures now at Burning Man.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Stuart Harvey. His show, Burning Man Pas de Deux with Marty, is on now at the Mark Woolley Gallery at Pioneer Place Mall through November the 15th. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO.
Oh, you're very welcome. Andy Warhol looks at screen.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series sponsored by Northwest Film Center. October 2nd through November 5th are the dates. While cinema provides entertainment and escape for many committed filmmakers and viewers, it's a vital medium of engagement and a powerful tool for social action. Films in the series include 50 Feet from Syria, Dreamcatcher, No Land's Song, and We Come as Friends. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film from October 2nd to November 5th at the Northwest Film Center in the Whitzel Auditorium of the Portland